Whoa. Well, we're live Sunday night. I've been on TV 28 years here. And my staff keeps coming up with ads. My staff should give credit where credit's due. Melissa keeps coming up with ads for 56. We're going to dump them all on Cal Brack one of these days because he promised to run the ads on Channel 56. We're there every night, Monday through Friday, from 10 to 11. And on Sunday night, from 7 to 11. And we're going to be here live until about 9:30. And then we'll play the service this morning, in spite of me saying I wouldn't. We'll play the service this morning from the cathedral. Between now and then, I'm taking reservations for the cathedral. Thanksgiving ends the tabernacle program. So this week's it. And Christmas is getting close. For your secret, 16 commitments. Since we're on so much in 56, and I ask you that watch on 56, if you appreciate all this time, get on the phone and tell me. I thought I'd read again. Washington, D.C. is one of the cities we're on. At 5:30 in the morning, on Channel 5. That means you have to be here at 2:30 to answer the phone. But look at the reaction of the people in our nation's capital. Manassas, Virginia, I'm standing up and applauding you at this hour, 6:10 a.m. in the morning, as I would applaud a great home run hitter or Muhammad Ali. Applauding you as a messenger of God for this hour. I thank you, young man. The intelligence in our capital city amazes me. We're in good hands if everybody in that city is this discerning. I thank you, young man. You are a young man in Christ. Too bad you folks here in Los Angeles think I've been here forever. Can't recognize that. Boonesboro, Maryland. This is my first time calling. I enjoy learning with the languages. I'll be supporting. Ashburn, Virginia. We get up at 5 a.m. every Sunday morning so we can watch Dr. Scott at 5:30. My wife and I enjoy Dr. Scott very much. Charlestown, West Virginia. I'm a first-time caller. I love your teaching and I would like to visit the cathedral. Well, if you start driving right now, you could be here next Sunday, couldn't you? I love your wife singing. I will continue to listen and call. Lanham, Maryland. I'd like to purchase some of the messages I've heard on this program. Well, you can, but not from the church, not from me. We don't engage in unrelated business and don't give you things for a contribution to avoid taxes. Dolores Press is a wholly owned, tax-paying subsidiary. They'll put the address on the screen. You can order the tape and book list there, and don't ever mix contribution checks to the church with the purchase of books or tapes. All the messages are available. About 60,000 hours, 28 years. Charlottesville, Virginia, fourth or fifth time watching. Very interesting. I love watching you. I'll keep watching. Washington, D.C., this program has been a blessing for me this morning. Tell the pastor I said thank you. And these are amazing messages. 1 hour, 5:30, Sunday morning. Washington, D.C., I feel so blessed to see this show. I understand the help zone. That was the message that played this morning. I'm going to Ramadan services. I feel like I was in the room where he was and that I had known him all my life. Washington, D.C., first-time watcher, I'd like to order the program that I'm watching. Rockville, Maryland, I just want to say that I'm enjoying this program. I'm a first-time caller. I'd like to thank you for the teaching. Washington, D.C., I enjoy the presentation very much. I've been watching every Sunday. Temple Hills, outside of D.C., first-time watcher. I really like this teacher. Tell him that I will continue to watch. This is great. Emmitsburg, Maryland. I've been watching for about 2 or 3 weeks. I've been through some rough times. I think he's great. I think he's a very, very smart and educated and spiritual man. I'll keep watching. Washington, D.C., first-time watcher. I'm telling you, people don't take long to decide. I'm enjoying this teacher. Tell him I'm watching. Is he a preacher? He has a lot of knowledge in different languages. I'm a teacher. Alexander, Virginia. I just want to say that I enjoyed this program this morning, and I'll be up every Sunday morning to listen. It was brilliant. I'm in the ministry, and I'm going to his website. I'm a first-time caller and will continue to call. Harrisburg, Virginia. I want to express my appreciation for the program. I've watched 3 or 4 times. He's a wonderful minister. Fayetteville, Pennsylvania. I just saw you for the first time, and I'm quite impressed with your teaching, and I'm interested in your pulpit publication, Washington, D.C. Dr. Scott's awesome. Please send me a list of his tapes. I need more of this. La Platte, Maryland. I really enjoyed that message. It was very inspiring. I learned a lot. I enjoyed his humor, too. I want a tape and book list and a copy of the pulpit. Capitol Hill, Maryland. I really like the way he breaks down the words. Again, this teaching has been a blessing to me today. I wish I could have recorded this program. Well, we did. Clinton, Maryland. I didn't see it all, but I really enjoy your program. The Hebrew and everything was perfect. That's what's needed, more the Hebrew and this kind of teaching. You look to be a true man of God. Prince George's County, Maryland. I enjoyed listening to Dr. Scott. I like the teaching here in Maryland. I thank him for his service to God and man. I first heard him on the radio in a military hospital. And thank him for his message. White Post, Virginia. I'm learning new cities, and I got a PhD minor from Stanford in geography. Hello. I'm calling to let you know how much I enjoy the programming. It's just amazing. Just a wonderful program. I just appreciate it. God bless all of you. Nanjimoy, Maryland. I listen to you every chance I get. I really enjoy and learn a lot from your teaching. I'm praying for your continued healing. I'd like to be on your mailing list. I wish we had more ministers who taught intelligently. You sure prove that wrong. That you can't be intelligent and be a Christian. Translated, you prove that that idea is wrong. Well, I agree. Chestertown, Maryland. I appreciate your study into the Word. I'd like to receive your letter, the cathedral pulpit. Thank you very much, and I'll be watching next Sunday. And I'd like to get a copy of that publication you offer. Thank you. I think you are an excellent teacher. Enjoy you very much from Fairfax, Virginia. You get every night, Monday through Friday from 10 to 11, and tonight from 7 to 11. I'd like to know that you folks in Los Angeles appreciate all this time on 56, so get on the telephone and tell me that. Now, I just thought I'd show you something. Doesn't need much comment. But before I do that, I want to comment to those that listen on the network. We're 24 hours a day, round the clock, internet, radio, analog, C-band, big dish, GE3, transponder 20, 24 hours a day. The internet, not just for the home page, but a live feed, 24 hours a day off the satellite. And we've introduced our own DirecTV to those that pick up the KU band, get any satellite installer to install it. I've heard prices anywhere from $300 to $650. And there we are, 24 hours a day, our own network. You can get the specifics, the numbers to tell your satellite installer, and he can tune it, and he tunes it only to our band on Telstar. And there we are, 24 hours a day. To those on network, you were listening in the previous half hour to a message I was reading by John Wright Follett. I used to travel around the country and constantly have people come up and say to me, were you trained by John Wright Follett? And I'm sorry, I didn't even know who he was at the time. Then I found out he was in his 80s, and he would go to a motel, and by word of mouth, hundreds and hundreds of people would gather just to listen to him teach. And I'd had this said to me so often, you remind me of John Wright Follett, you teach some of the same things that he teaches. I hadn't even read a book by him. And then Ralph Wilkerson of Melodyland gave me a book, Broken Bread, and that's what I was reading from. It's the first thing I'd gotten that John Wright Follett had written that I read. And almost about the same time, I got a call from George Otis, who had founded High Adventure, and my father and I had ordained him. And he said that he and Pat Boone, and I had participated with Pat Boone and George Otis to found Bible Voice before High Adventure, that put the first two messages ever put on audio tapes. One by Billy Graham, and a message I preached on Psalm 84. And to meander this a bit further, I was pleased to know that when Red Foley, Pat Boone's father, died, she almost had a total nervous breakdown. Stayed in her room and the blinds drawn, and George Otis had delivered the tape on Psalm 84, and it brought her out of her grief and condition. And when her mother died, she went with the family to play that tape and minister to them. So Pat and George and I had these connections, and George called me and said, Pat and I have scheduled John Wright Follett to conduct a Bible study in our home. And I think you should at least meet him. This could be the last one that he conducts at his age. So I was scheduled to be in El Paso, Texas, and I changed my schedules and flew by, picked up by George, and went to his house. And there was a big room in his house where everybody was gathered for one of these Hollywood Bible study groups that was very popular after the outpouring and the Episcopal Church over in Hollywood, of which George had been a member. And that's the only time I met him. He and I began to talk. And about 2 hours later, we were still sitting out by the pool at George's house, and George and Pat Boone had to conduct the Bible study. There was a witness of spirit, and it's two of the most blessed hours I ever spent. But as we parted, he said to me, Gene, don't let it kill you. Talking about unpacking the word, he says, it comes so hard, and people take it so casually, it'll kill you if you let it. Don't let it kill you. Taking me a lot of years, it was only a matter of weeks or months after that that John Wright Follett went home to his reward. But I've come to know what he meant. And these old tigers, thank God, they laid the path that I'm able to build on. And I listen to judgmental Christians all the time. They're bothered by my cigar. I smoke it on purpose just to wave it as a freedom stick in their face. And don't talk to me about stumbling block, because most people don't know what stumbling block means. You can't, if you know enough to criticize, you can't stumble. The stumbling block that the New Testament defines is someone whose conscience has not been set free by the Word. There are many things that God doesn't care about at all, but if you think it's wrong, it's sin for you to do it. That's what Romans makes very clear in the 14th chapter. I, with my mind, I said, well, why is that true? If it's sort of neutral to God, why is it a sin for you to do it just because you think it's wrong? Because it presupposes a rebellious spirit and a self-willed determination to do something that you think, even if you're wrong, that you think will offend the Lord who died for you. That's a rebellious spirit. And Paul admonishes that if someone has confidence in you and their conscience isn't free and they haven't been taught in the Word enough to know that it's wrong, or not wrong, God doesn't care about it. And when I was a teenager and they were saying everything was a sin, I went through the Bible and memorized every one of those passages that declare absolutes, things that God's always against. No matter where you are, when you're doing it, He's always against it. Six things God hates. Seven are an abomination unto Him. And the seventh, been totally forgotten by the church world, sowing discord among the brethren. Now, if you're with someone and they think something's wrong, then teach them and free their conscience, lest you set an example of doing something and their confidence in you makes them imitate your behavior and violate their conscience. So for a cup of coffee, am I going to offend the conscience of this one that has confidence in me? No, I'm going to train him, going to teach him. Now you take that out of context, and there's somebody everywhere that thinks something's a sin that isn't. The weak and the strong is the way Paul characterizes them. The strong have been set free in their conscience, know what God's against, and know the difference between what God's against and what other Christians are against, and traditions that make void the Word of God. But I've also come to know that the weak fake the weak in this generation. They ain't weak at all. They're fruit inspectors. Oh, they won't judge you, but by your fruit you'll be known, so they're going to inspect your fruit. Judging is always a sin. So I quit a long time ago catering to the phony weak, who are really the strong that have become the majority and want to beat you to death if you don't conform to their little behavioral stunt. And I remember I started on television when the television evangelists were all being exposed as crooks and robbers, until the word television evangelist, if you were on TV and talked about God, immediately you were a television evangelist. Became an epithet like kike or nigger or some other class-based animus. And I did everything to try to separate from television evangelists. I'm a pastor, but I hated that word. I'm not a televangelist. I tried everything. Said there's so many horses' asses on religious television, we're going to show you what the whole horse looks like. I wore hats. But finally I said, well, if I'm smoking this cigar, they're not going to think I'm Jimmy Swaggart, Jerry Falwell, or Jimmy Baker. And I don't see anything in God's Word that says, thou shalt not smoke cigars, or thou shalt not smoke anything. I can give you health arguments, but not moral and biblical arguments. And looking at most of the preachers that are condemning everything you do, if I look at their waistline, it would seem to me that they've violated one of those absolute sins called gluttony. No compromise on that. Plenty of Bible about that. So, you know, I'm not too kind toward a glutton that's judging me. He's a glutton and he judges. That's two absolutes. And then I also begin to notice these preachers all decked out in everything from red suits to purple shoes. Getting on women. No pun intended, but maybe. Now, I'm old enough, remember when women couldn't cut their hair and couldn't wear makeup? Now they do about everything on religious channels, but, you know, hail the women. I said, this cigar will separate me. The only thing that, it's not full of chemicals. I don't inhale it. It doesn't make me addicted, not near as much as white sugar will make you addicted. It's a burning bush. And the only thing in the Bible about a burning bush is one where God talked to Moses. The difference between this one, it burns and is consumed. So I guess God's not going to talk to me through this one. But I get sort of amused because I have the flower pot that G. Campbell Morgan used to stash his cigar in before he went to the pulpit down at the church on Hope Street. Charles Spurgeon used to enjoy a good cigar. And everybody with any brains, and most of those preachers, most preachers that condemn that, have Spurgeon and G. Campbell Morgan in their library. And they plagiarize their material without giving credit, and that's stealing. That's one of the absolutes. Thou shalt not steal. Now, it's no wonder I almost lost my faith growing up in the church and seeing the hypocrisy that went on. And I've told you this story. I used to have an evangelist come to my dad, pastoring in Orville, every fall. He showed up every fall. God sent him. God called him to Orville after pheasant season opened in the pheasant bowl of Northern California and duck season opened. And I watched him. I mean, he had a belly that made him sway his back to hold it up as he walked. And I watched him eat. My mom couldn't cook enough for him. He embodied gluttony. And he'd get up at daylight and grab his shotgun, put his hip boots on, use my dad's contacts and go out in the rice fields, hunt ducks all day, come in about 6:30, 7 o'clock, rip his boots off and try to dress. And we teenagers happened to notice he had to do it so fast he didn't zip his pants up. One night when he was sitting on the platform and the flab that was jutting forward covered everything else, so he still was okay. I mean, he hadn't seen his private parts in at least 60 years. Somebody said to him, I'm making this up, why don't you dye it? And he says, well, what color is it now? Let me run that by again. He was so fat, he says, I haven't seen my, private parts in years. And his friend across the way said, well, why don't you dye it? He says, what color is it now? Now, you want that the third time or are you getting it? Anyway, he'd come in and beat the saints to death. I better get on with this one. And beat the saints to death because they hadn't prayed all day. And that's why we didn't have revival. I hate hypocrites. So they carry in their library, G. Campbell Morgan, one of the best, and they plagiarize his sermons, and Charles Spurgeon, and one of the greatest Christians to live, probably has influenced more people toward Christ than anybody in the last two or three generations, C.S. Lewis. He's got one of the churches down in Orange County, I think, has a stained glass window of him. He's smoking a pipe. Then I just happened to get this book recently, C.S. Lewis' Journey to Faith, The Most Reluctant Convert. I'd challenge that because I think I maybe topped him in reluctance. Now, I'm sure that the Sister Sals that are watching will say this picture was taken before he was converted. I got news for you. See if you can zoom in close enough to see what's in his finger. This is C.S. Lewis. What do you see there? So, you judges and judgmental people, to hell with you, because that's where you're going. Judge not that you be not judged. Now, having said that, I think I got something to say before tonight's over about this Da Vinci Code. But before I say something about that, I want to read from Babylon Mystery Religion, Ralph Edward Woodrow. I give credit. And years ago, I spent a lot of time on this. But as we move toward Christmas, I think it's time to drag this book out again and educate people a little bit about Christmas. We got a Christmas tree over here, just on the other side of my monkey band. I like Christmas trees. I particularly like them if they got gifts under them to me. But that's not a symbol of the cross. And the wise men did not exchange gifts with Christmas, with Christ. And I have a few more things to say, starting with the fact he wasn't born December 25th. But before I do that, I want you on the phone telling me whether you appreciate this time on 56. And before I start teaching, I want my regulars to check in, and we're short of volunteers. Some of you that made commitments have slacked off. I want volunteers for training here in the studio, camera trainees on Saturday night at the cathedral, security volunteers at two or three of our church locations. And you regulars know that I pastor in front of this camera with you, so get on the phone and call me in these next few minutes. Oh, well, I want some more calls. You're doing pretty good. The lines are pretty busy. And if you don't get through, just dial again after about seven rings. There's plenty of people here. Someone called from Washington, D.C. or one of these cities and said, oh, how nice to hear a live voice. I thought I'd get a recording. No, we're here. And this is live. So get on the telephone. Okay, no more calls. I want to talk now. Be courteous and finish the calls that you have. Fill in the chat rooms across the country, producing a special by ABC. Taking the approach of a novel, mixing fact with fiction. Dan Brown, a genius in my view, produced this novel, The Da Vinci Code. Now, it's as old as the bestseller of the 90s, late 80s and 90s, Holy Blood, Holy Grail, and we spent almost a year teaching on Christianity's entrance into the south of France and the factual basis in separating the interpretations of that bestseller, Holy Blood, Holy Grail, from the facts. The facts are, in the book of Acts, there's a statement, all the Christians, because of persecution, fled from the coast, except the apostles. The facts are, with Joseph of Arimathea, who had a fleet of ships and brought 10 from Cornwall and Glastonbury, the very one who brought the body of Jesus off the cross, who had, as a member of the Sanhedrin, power with the Jews, and as Jerome called him, the noblest decorum, an official position as Minister of Mines with Pilate. He had access to both. And the facts are that those of the little band that was constantly mentioned in the Gospels close around Jesus, people who would shake, people who would shake any town of just a few people, how do you think people would react? Well, I remember a little town that probably none of you have heard of, about 10 miles from Oroville in Northern California, Palermo. I'd go out there quail hunting. Or where I kept my headquarters when I was traveling for 18 years overseas. I had P.O. Box 1, Canyon Dam, California. And I think the sign says 44 inhabitants. You've come a long way, baby. I'm P.O. Box 1 in Los Angeles now. I remember Tom Bradley. When Tom Bradley ran for governor, he asked me if he could get P.O. Box 1 for me. There's only one P.O. Box 1. That's my P.O. Box 1. I said to him, no, not for any price, Tom. But when he was running for governor, it would have been nice if he could have said, Tom Bradley, P.O. Box 1, Los Angeles. But I once had P.O. Box 1, Canyon Dam, California. Now, if somebody in Canyon Dam had been raised from the dead like Lazarus, it'd be pretty hard to forget him in that little town. He'd be on the sign, home of Lazarus, and 43 others. And Gene Scott, 42 others. What is one of the great mysteries of the New Testament is these people, if you count in the Gospels, those that were close to him. The man born blind, the daughter that was raised, the healings that he performed, the miracles, the woman with the issue of blood, blind Bartimaeus, the man that was let down after they tore the roof off. They disappear. And Acts makes it clear. The followers of Christ fled the persecution. James was able to stay as the pastor because he was an Essene. And he pastored for 19 years in Jerusalem. Nobody thought he believed Jesus was the Messiah because the Pharisees came to him and thought he would deny that Jesus was the Messiah. And after 19 years, his cover broke. He had, tradition says he had knees like camel knees from praying in the temple. That's why he fought so hard for what I'd call Jesus is the Messiah Judaism. Jesus is the Messiah. He never followed Jesus. He was converted by the resurrection. And it was he who presided the councils because he was viewed as a relative. In the Middle Eastern tradition, a relative inherits. And he preached a Christianity that accepted Jesus as Messiah, but still kept the law, Judaism, in its wholeness. He stayed because he could fellow travel with the Jews of the day. The rest of the Christians all fled, disappeared. They crop up in the south of France. Lazarus was the first bishop of Marseille. You go up through the south of France, you come to little two-bit towns, giant cathedrals dedicated to the memory, Mary, Martha, and those that are close in that group around Jesus. Mary Magdalene, Martha. From that spring, the legend that the Holy Grail was the carrier of Jesus' blood, that Mary was, in fact, the wife of Jesus, and she carried a son conceived by Jesus, born in France. The Merovingian kings claim to spring from that line by this theory, the long-haired kings. And the Priori di Sion protects the secret of that bloodline, and part of the secret is penned in the Dossier Secret, which is in the National Museum in Paris. And this theory has been widespread for years. And thus the Holy Grail is not a chalice, but Mary and the bloodline that flows from her union with Christ and a natural son. We went through with Holy Blood, Holy Grail, but that was a factual, and they made clear when they were interpreting, as distinct from the facts. This book is done by a genius, the Da Vinci Code. It's sort of interesting to give it credibility. They have facts. The Priori of Sion, a European secret society founded in 1099, is a real organization. In 1975, Paris Bibliothèque Nationale discovered parchments known as Les Dossiers Secrets, identifying numerous members of the Priori of Sion, including Sir Isaac Newton, Botticelli, Victor Hugo, and Leonardo da Vinci, who were the head of the Priori that guards this secret, waiting for the time to reveal who ought to rule Europe, the descendant of Jesus. The Vatican prelature, known as Opus Dei, is a deeply devout Catholic sect that has been the topic of recent controversy due to reports of brainwashing, coercion, and dangerous practices known as corporal mortification. Opus Dei has just completed construction of a 47 million national headquarters at 243 Lexington Avenue in New York City. All descriptions of artwork, architecture, documents, and secret rituals in this novel are accurate. He's a genius. His knowledge of art, mathematics, and mythological symbolism is mind-boggling. And he takes this theory and weaves a novel that will not only be a bestseller, it's going to become, I'm sure, it'll be a movie. And as I said, and I've already covered some of the things that are so brilliant in it, like the codes that are traced through the book and the use of symbolism and mathematical formulas. You end up saying, man, this guy knows what he's talking about. And he does, in his area. Art history, symbolism, numerology, mathematics, mythology. The man knows what he's talking about. Christianity, he'll know beans. But I remember doing my undergraduate major in history, and I've told this story repeatedly. The professors gained my respect because they wouldn't speak on a subject that they had not expertised themselves about, except religion. They would speak with authority on religion. They'd speak with authority on the gospel documents. And I was pounded to believe that I couldn't get my academic wings until I accepted Jesus as a good and wise teacher who went about saying and doing good and wise things. But because I've always searched and looked and turned the rocks over, I began to discern they were transferring an authority that, and they were without a conscience on it. They had already concluded that Christianity is not intellectual anyway, so it didn't demand any research. And they would make their pronouncements, like on the resurrection, it can't happen, therefore it didn't happen, and therefore anybody says it did is either nuts or lying, or gullible, because it can't happen, and therefore it didn't happen. Anybody that writes about it is beneath my examination, Christianity says it can't happen. If it did happen, stop. Pay attention to this guy. But where the crack in their intellectual armor appeared is, as I began to dig deep and study myself and examine the sources, and I remember in my first class in historiography where they were using the textbook that just parroted what the textbooks for the last 20 years had said, that any source you want to go to, if you say Jesus is a good and wise teacher, you've got to say to me, well, on what is that based? It's either on what he said or what he did. So where do I go to see what he said and did? What are you basing this on? Well, most of the time they'd quote the Gospels. But it doesn't matter. I've made a life passion out of collecting manuscripts. You just looked at the Ethiopic manuscripts. Probably won't see those anywhere in the world. Those ancient Ethiopic manuscripts, I made it my business to dig into the sources. I don't care what source you use. The Jesus Seminar is making a big deal out of the so-called hypothetical Q document. And featured on TV, we'll see this Elaine Padgel, I think is her name, expert on the Nag Hammadi finds. Well, I have down in the ladies' lounge area at the entrance on the basement side where the ladies' lounge is in the collection, I have a copy of the highly touted Gospel of Thomas found at Nag Hammadi that the Jesus Seminar people would try to say is older than the Gospels. And I've yellow-marked the claims and the sayings of Jesus that preclude calling him good and wise. He could be good if he's nuts, believing the impossible things about himself, but not wise. He could be wise if he was a con artist sufficient to convince people of these impossible claims about himself, but not good. Sorry, ruled out. And C.S. Lewis is one of the first that I found saying this, that you have to conclude with Jesus is either in the category of somebody that believes he can become a poached egg, or he's what he said he was. He goes around wherever you find any record subjected to the minimal historic tests, you're going to find Jesus saying things about himself that no mortal man has a right to say. The Jews were right. If he wasn't God, he blasphemed. But I took the history professor's word for things because I assumed they would look. This book has the same effect on you. By the time you get to where he's discussing Christianity in chapter 55, you think, well, he knows what he's talking about. And he talks through the mouths of his characters in this novel. And here we have the heroine and the hero. The heroine's going to turn out to be a descendant of Mary Magdalene. And they are talking to a knighted Britisher who's made his life a seeking after and studying the Grail. So they're seated on a divan beside Langdon, who is the symbologist that is a professor that covers the world and teaches on symbolism. Sophie drank her tea. That's the girl who will ultimately find out she's a descendant of Jesus. And ate a scone, feeling the welcome effects of caffeine and food. And of course, they're on the run at this time, being accused of the murder of her grandfather, who was the curator at the Louvre, who starts them on this quest the night that he's murdered by mysterious codes and messages he wrote on the floor, and spread his naked body as he was dying from a gut shot from a crazy man that's seeking the key to the Grail. And they've been following these codes, and they're being pursued by the law. And Sir Lee Teabing was beaming as he awkwardly paced before the open fire, his leg braces, because he was a cripple, clicking on the stone hearth. "The Holy Grail," Teabing said, his voice sermonic. "Most people ask me only where it is. I fear that's a question I may never answer. However, the far more relevant question is this. What is the Holy Grail? Sophie asks some questions. Teabing says, to fully understand the Grail, we must first understand the Bible. How well do you know the New Testament? He said to the lady. I warn you.
No,
sir. Sophie shrugs, not at all, really. I was raised by a man who worshipped Leonardo da Vinci. Teabing looked both startled and pleased, an enlightened soul, superb. Then you must be aware that Leonardo was one of the keepers of the secret of the Holy Grail, and he hid clues in his art. Robert told me as much. That's Langdon, the symbologist. Yes. And Da Vinci's views on the New Testament? He asked the girl. I have no idea. Robert, would you mind on the bottom shelf, La Storia di Leonardo? And across found the art book, flipped the pages from Da Vinci's notebook on polemics and speculation. Sophie read the words. Many have made a trade of delusions and false miracles, deceiving the stupid multitude. I want to tell you, he's accurate on Leonardo. And he's accurate on the views of the Priori di Sion. I could probably find you a whole lot of people in the Christian community that would like to fabricate a convincing story that they were a descendant of Jesus. Doesn't make it true. Here's another, Teabing said. I mean, everybody knows Leonardo da Vinci was a rebel, and blinding ignorance does mislead us. Oh, wretched mortals, open your eyes. Leonardo da Vinci. Sophie felt a little chill. Da Vinci's talking about the Bible? Teabing nodded. Leonardo's feelings about the Bible relate directly to the Holy Grail. In fact, Da Vinci painted the true Grail, which I will show you momentarily, but first we must speak of the Bible. And, of course, you who saw the ABC thing, he's going to... the painting of the Last Supper has Mary Magdalene next to Jesus, and the V, as their body shape, is related to the symbolism. I'll skip that. Everything you know about the Bible can be summed up with a great canon, Dr. Martin Percy. Teabing cleared his throat and declared, quote, the Bible did not arrive by facts from heaven. Well, amen and amen. In other words, I'd have missed it because I hate fax machines. I beg your pardon? The Bible is a product of man, my dear, not of God. The Bible did not fall magically from the clouds. Man created it as a historical record of tumultuous times, and it has evolved through countless translations, additions, and revisions. History has never had a definite version of the book. I'd like to take this writer through my Bible collection. I mean, I've talked about Christianity as they worship the Torah in some respects above God. As the copyists would copy, there were others that would count the letters. You want me to continue?
Yes, sir.
Then I get on the telephone. Okay, no more calls. I'm going to keep reading. The point I'm making is the expertise that exudes from the book on art and mythology and symbols is not, gives a sense that when he says something, it's accurate. He's not done the same study on Christianity, how the Bible developed, and the records of the New Testament. My guess is he couldn't read a line of Ethiopic, couldn't read a line of Coptic, couldn't read a line of Syriac, couldn't read a line of Arabic, probably couldn't read Hebrew or Greek. But if he can, my guess is he hasn't spent too much time on how we got our Bible, and in 58 stations demonstrated by the manuscripts themselves, we trace that history at the cathedral. A lifetime of searching after, once I settled the resurrection, I wanted to know what the canon should consist of. I wouldn't take anybody's word for it. He doesn't have the same knowledge, yet he speaks with the same authority, using these fictitious figures to speak. Jesus Christ was a historical figure of staggering influence, perhaps the most enigmatic and inspirational leader the world has ever seen. As the prophesied Messiah, Jesus toppled kings, inspired millions, and founded new philosophies. And I wonder which Bible he's taking here for the authority that he was the prophesied Messiah. As a descendant of the lines of King Solomon and King David, how does he know that? I mean, that's a Bible record. There are those that will say David never existed. Jesus possessed a rightful claim to the throne of the King of the Jews. How does he know that he descended from David and Solomon? That's in the biblical genealogies. Understandably, his life was recorded by thousands of followers across the land. Teething paused to sip his tea. He should have taken a big drag of something else. And then placed the cup back on the mantle. More than, not underlined, but in italics, more than 80 Gospels were considered for the New Testament. Give me the list. And yet only a relative few were chosen for inclusion. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John among them. Well, where's the other two or three that they're among? Who chose which Gospels to include, Sophie asked. Oh, man, I'm on the edge of my seat now. Aha! Teeming burst in with enthusiasm. The fundamental irony of Christianity, the Bible as we know it today, was collated by the pagan Roman emperor Constantine the Great. Bovine scatology. I thought Constantine was a Christian, Sophie said. Hardly, Teeming scoffed. He was a lifelong pagan who was baptized on his deathbed, too weak to protest. Not because he wasn't a Christian, and not because he is too weak to protest, but because he himself had difficulty deciding between Arian and Athanasius, which was the fight of the Council of Nicaea. In Constantine's day, Rome's official religion was sun worship. The cult of Sol Invictus, that's true until he Christianized the empire, or the invincible sun, and Constantine was its head priest. Unfortunately for him, a growing religious turmoil was gripping Rome. 3 centuries after the crucifixion of Jesus Christ, Christ's followers had multiplied exponentially. Christians and pagans began warring, and the conflict grew to such proportions that it threatened to rend Rome in two. Constantine decided something had to be done. In 325 A.D., he decided to unify Rome under a single religion, Christianity. Sophie was surprised. Why would a pagan emperor choose Christianity as official religion? Teeming chuckled. Constantine was a very good businessman. He could see that Christianity was on the rise, and he simply backed the winning horse. Historians still marvel at the brilliance with which Constantine converted the sun-worshipping pagans to Christianity. By fusing pagan symbols, dates, rituals into the growing Christian tradition, he created a kind of hybrid religion that was acceptable to both parties. I will show you, as I go to Christmas, wasn't Constantine that mixed Mithraism with Christianity? Transmogrification, Langdon said. He's the guy that's the symbol expert. The vestiges of pagan religion and Christian symbology are undeniable. The Egyptian sun disk became the halos of Catholic saints. True, but not because of Constantine. Pictograms of Isis nursing her miraculous conceived son, Horus, became the blueprint for our modern images of the Virgin Mary nursing baby Jesus. More than that, I could teach him a few things. There's Indranian child, right up here. Indranian child. Get in close. That's India. And here's Devaki and Krishna, right here. That's India. And we get around Isis and Horus, which goes back to ancient Babylon, the wife Semiramis of Nimrod, the first rebel. And because Nimrod died and she had Tammuz much longer than 9 months after Nimrod was dead, she had to claim that Nimrod had returned to his deity position as the sun, and the sunbeam became a sperm-carrying instrument, and she conceived Tammuz, and thus Tammuz was Nimrod reborn. And there's the origin of the mother and child that spread in the myth through all the language frames and through all the cultures. No doubt, but it wasn't Constantine who merged all this. And virtually all the elements of the Catholic ritual, the mitre, the altar, the doxology, and the communion, the act of God-eating, were taken directly from earlier pagan mystery religion. That's true. Teeming grown, don't get a symbologist started on Christian icons. We shouldn't have opened with this icon ad, should we? Nothing in Christianity is original. The pre-Christian god Mithras, called the Son of God and the Light of the World, was born on December 25th. He's taken away what I'm going to do later. Died, was buried in a rock tomb, and then resurrected in 3 days. No, he didn't. That's wrong. By the way, December 25th is also the birthday of Osiris, Adonis, Dionysius. They're all just different cultural duplicates of Tammuz. The newborn Krishna was represented with gold, frankincense, and myrrh. So what? Even Christianity's weekly holy day was stolen from the pagans. Yes, Sunday. All of this relates to the Grail. Constantine needed to strengthen the new Christian tradition and held a famous ecumenical gathering known as the Council of Nicaea. Sophia had heard of it only insofar as it being the birthplace of the Nicene Creed. At this gathering, Teabing said, many aspects of Christianity were debated and voted upon: the date of Easter, the role of bishops and administration of sacraments, and of course, the divinity of Jesus. I don't follow his divinity. My dear Teabing declared, until that moment in history, Jesus was viewed by his followers as a mortal prophet, a great and powerful man, but a man nonetheless a mortal. Not the Son of God? Right. Jesus' establishment as the Son of God was officially proposed and voted on by the Council of Nicaea. I wish I could say what I want to say. Not bovine scatology, but just plain unadulterated BS. But I'm on TV, I can't do it. He's ignorant of the basis of the Council of Nicaea. Constantine didn't canonize the books. Origen, a century and a half to 2 centuries earlier, the famous Origen of the Hexapla, that did more to perpetuate the translations of the Old Testament into the New through the Greek, in addition to the Septuagint. We have copies. I just got another set of copies to go on display. Origen argued for the four Gospels. I have the three oldest Bibles in the world, the Sinaiticus and the Vaticanus, copies of them, rare copies, made for libraries. We're fortunate to be one of those that have copies of the Sinaiticus, about 340 A.D., Alexandrinus, 5th century, Vaticanus, same time, probably same scriptorium in Caesarea, 340 A.D. We have copies of the Chester Beatty Papyrus, taking us back to the 2nd century. I just read from a website today an archaeological discovery in Jerusalem of an inscription on a tomb written by a not very sophisticated writer, like an ordinary person, memorializing on a tomb, a passage from Luke. And they make the comment, it is exact. An exact quote from the Sinaiticus, that manuscript discovered by Tischendorf at St. Catherine's Monastery, which we have a copy of. And they concluded, he must have had a copy of the Sinaiticus to order to quote so exactly. No, just maybe they both had a copy that they both quoted from. The expertise here on the Bible sucks. Each of those three oldest Bibles that exist in the world, the three oldest extant complete Bibles, Each of them have some different books in the New Testament that had not yet been canonized. It took two councils in North Africa between the 4th and 5th century to eventually establish the canon and declare what was in the canon. And it took the American and British Bible Societies to take the Apocrypha out in the 1800s. And 5,000 manuscripts have been found since the King James was translated, and not even 2% variation occurs. And I've been spending 4 years now with just the book of Romans, paralleling Arabic, Ethiopic, Coptic, Syriac, Hebrew translation back from the Greek. The deviations are in modern translations. All these ancient horizontal translations say the same thing. People who worship the book and want truth instead of modern scholars who want to perpetrate their own idea felt they were translating God's Word. And the checks and balances make it the most accurately transmitted document ever written by man's hand. And I don't say that because somebody told me that. Go to the cathedral and look at the manuscripts. Don't think I'm right, know I'm right. I don't care if he wants to speculate in his novel here. Constantine didn't have a thing to do with determining the canon. And the Council of Nicaea was not to determine whether Jesus was divine or not, because the Christian message began with the proclamation of the resurrection. And that's a pretty divine act. It was, what was the relationship between the Jesus of history and the eternal Son of God, whom John says moved into this tent of flesh? And what was the relationship between the Son and the Father? Once Jesus' divinity was accepted and had been argued about from the first century till the Council of Nicaea, and the Arians who followed Arius had a certain view, and the followers of Athanasius had another, and they had to settle this issue. There had been debates for centuries and church councils prior to that. Never a deviation on his divinity in the conclusions of the mainstream of the church. What was the nature of the relationship in the Godhead between the eternal and the revelation in flesh, where God became flesh and kinned himself to us in the deliverance action and the faith of Christ that brought our redemption? It had nothing to do with deciding for the first time in the 4th century that he was divine. I don't think anybody questions Paul was preaching and wrote to Rome in 58 A.D. And Paul certainly is preaching a divine Christ. The Gospels, we don't know which one was written first. For years I've been with the majority scholars that are fundamental and evangelical in their beliefs that Mark wrote first. I've begun to question that of late and realize that in my early history days there's another vestigial remnant of looking at it as a history document. Once the resurrection occurred and you believe in divine inspiration, I'm now moving to the position they were independent, except for Luke, who says several have tried to put down these facts, and I'm going to put down the accurate record. Come on Easter Sunday to the cathedral, and I will deal with the basis for our faith. This is an enjoyable book. I had a lot of fun with it. I could go on with his half-baked viewpoint of Jesus was considered man, and it took Constantine to strong-arm the church council in the 3rd century, and he decided what would be in the canon. What an idiot. The canonization started, and the major conflict occurred in 140 A.D., when a brilliant businessman, Marcion, decided the only one worth listening to was Paul. And he canonized. He canonized the epistles of Paul and edited Luke. And about 85% of the Christian community became Marcionites, and there was never a question among the Marcionites whether Jesus was divine. The question was whether or not other views than Luke and Paul were to be considered. And the church, seeing a canon, which they didn't have, passing on by laying on of hands, the church made the decisions, and the bishops made the decisions, and they read in the church the letters of the various ones, and there's an evidence that Matthew wrote at Antioch, and Mark wrote either in Rome or Alexandria. Luke, he wrote, we don't know where for sure, and each of these, and John, probably wrote at Ephesus. Each of these Gospels began to circulate. The letters of Paul were written before the Gospels. Marcion created the challenge the church had to respond to and develop a canon for the church. And they came up with the criteria, if it was an apostle or one that had direct contact with the apostle, they canonized that. Period. James did not get accepted until the 5th century. And Luther still didn't accept James, didn't believe the brother of Christ or cousin of Christ or half-brother of Christ even wrote it, and says it's a right story little epistle, not one word of gospel in it. It never made it to the canon until the 5th century. Constantine wanted the fight between the Arians and the followers of Athanasius settled. And they came up with the Trinitarian doctrine, later to be refined with the role of the Holy Spirit, and the church went into the Nicene Creed, established theological stream, and everything else was heresy. Constantine had nothing to do with the canonization. He was going to settle the conflict between powerful bishops, Arian, and everybody, once the decision was made to go with Athanasius, everybody had to vote. And all of those that followed Arian, except two, or Arius except two, voted, because if they didn't vote with the majority that Constantine had decided, they were banished. So yes, he played a part in calling the council that produced the creed that ultimately developed into the full-fledged Trinitarian creed, but he didn't canonize the scripture. And this guy doesn't know what he's talking about when he starts talking about the history of Christianity. Go ahead and enjoy the book, just like go ahead and enjoy a Christmas tree. But don't call it Christian, it's a phallic symbol. Go ahead and enjoy it more, most of you Christians will. Particularly the fundamentalists. Don't mislead your kids and tell them that this is a symbol of the cross. It's not. Don't tell them Jesus was born on December 25th. All I have to tell you is the scripture makes it clear. The shepherds were tending their flocks in the fields. If you've ever been in Bethlehem in December, there's snow on the ground. You don't have sheep in the fields in December. It's the birthday of the sun, the end of the winter, the start of the sun's climb back up. And it's straight out of Babylon, as I will show you in the next half hour or so. That part of his story is correct. I have a page, copy of a page, and we'll shortly be receiving the life of Mary Magdalene of Veronis. It's in Bodleian Library at Oxford. It used to be in the Magdalene College Library. And I will be receiving a copy of it. I'll put on display. It's got 50 chapters. It assembles. Do I think it's inspired? No. Put together from earlier sources in the 10th century is the life of Mary Magdalene, and traces these close followers of Jesus in their trek and their subsequent history in the south of France. She wasn't carrying any child by Jesus. She married Maximus. And you'll find Lazarus and Mary and Martha. And the only place you will find in the world that the relics of Mary and Martha and Lazarus and those close to Jesus are revered is in the south of France. These great cathedrals were built over. Now, I'm not a relic worshiper, nor do I think that all relics have validity. But when you have just one place on the earth that the relics of certain people in the history are constantly claimed and worshipped, I think wrongfully. The icons look beyond the icon to that which it portrayed. The worship of relics comes close to idolatry. But the relics of Mary and Martha and those close ones are in the south of France. And I'll put on display this life of Mary Magdalene. And as I said, I don't think it's inspired. That's why it would not be part of the book. But in its stretching and connecting dots that may not be there, it is assembling a solid base. And it doesn't include a natural child by Jesus. And it sure does include her marriage to Maximus, a good woman, a devoted follower of Jesus. But this book would have us return to the female goddess and leads us on a trip to the place where he says her bones are buried and you'll have fun solving the riddles. But he's not an expert on the history of Christianity. So just write BS across those pages and move on. Get on telephone. 56. Here in Los Angeles. I'm watching this show and it's pretty cool. I'll keep watching. Good. And here's Long Beach. I want to say hello to Dr. Scott and let him know we love his program. These are either first-timers or new people. Likewise here, I want to make my reservation for next Sunday. Hopok, New York, watching on the Internet. I'm appreciating the programming tonight and the teaching you're doing. Please continue the teaching. I want to talk about Christmas in a few minutes, but I want you to respond. And I'm saying to those that joined late, we will, about an hour from now, about 9:30, we will lift the curtain and take you to the cathedral service this morning where I keep teaching on Romans. But for the next hour, we're going to be here just talking to you, and I want to teach you about some of the myths of Christmas. That's in that book, Da Vinci Code. He's right about the amalgamation of myths and Christianity, but it wasn't done to Constantine. It was done in the years that followed by the medieval church. I'm going to talk about it. Right now, I want you to get on the telephone. Pretty good. I want my regulars calling. I put out an appeal this morning for renewal of your commitments as Voice of Faith early Sunday morning from 2:30 on. We have enough King's Houses here in Los Angeles to man these phones round the clock with 8 or 10 people here at least every night. I want you to renew your commitments. We need volunteers through this flu season, the holiday period. Some that we count on are sick and can't make it. We need volunteers at the cathedral. You just need to tell us when you're available. We'll assign you. And volunteers that are learning to do the air shift, camera trainees on Saturday nights, and you regulars know what you're to do. Get on the telephone, make your reservations, and get busy. If you want me to keep teaching tonight, you better get on the phone and call me right now. Okay, no more calls. Again, be courteous. Finish the calls you're on. Don't get into long speeches. I want to read from Babylon Mystery Religion by Ralph Edward Woodrow. Nimrod, whose name means rebel, was the first rebel. He was the architect and king that tried to build the Tower of Babel. You encounter him in the Nineveh tablets that were dug up and the Epic of Gilgamesh. It's another name for Nimrod, who went searching the head of the family that had survived the flood, which would be Noah. Shacks up with some broad in Lebanon, and finds that the head of this family, which would be Noah's, offshore in the Mediterranean, which is Crete, which gives suggestion that that great kingdom of Crete, which had the first fleet, why not, first boat builder, was none other than Noah. But in the Bible, he is the rebel, the son of a cursed line as a result of Ham's evil acts and ratting on Noah and judging him. Noah was drunk. If you read the apocryphal literature, he's doing worse. But he still got up when he sobered up and prophesied, and his prophecy came true. Shem and Japheth covered him up, and Ham ratted on him. I like that. That means God considers gossiping and judging worse than getting drunk. And, you know, my fundamentalist friends, I don't think I have any. If I do, I'm going to try to do something about that. My fundamentalist friends, quote, never have answered the biblical truth that the first miracle that Jesus performed was to turn water to wine to keep the party going. Jesus was a winemaker. But Christmas is coming on, and it's always so funny to see the talking heads get religious come Christmas. And then they try to be neutral and expansive and expert, about as empty of knowledge as this author is on the history of the formation of the Bible. And then they keep, every Christmas, they keep coming up with new religions that want to piggyback on the Christmas season. Now, I've told my people for years, the only truly biblical, religious December celebration, because it's accurate in its history, is Hanukkah. And I'm sorry that my Jewish friends, and I have friends there, I'm sorry that they emphasize it as a festival of lights and play down the real origin of Hanukkah, the Maccabean rebellion, and the revolt against Antiochus Epiphanes, the successor of Alexander the Great and the Seleucid portion of the kingdom. Epiphanes means God manifest. And it's the first entrance into mankind's development of law and the judicial system of what our Supreme Court likes to practice today, which is neutrality toward religion. Except, and I'm not so sure that the Supreme Court's distant from that either. Jefferson wanted to balance power because he recognized man so sinful, the only way you can keep us from destroying one another is to balance the power. But the Supreme Court has become like the old Chinese mandarins. They brook no contest with their will. But they supposedly practice neutrality. Antiochus Epiphanes practiced that. You can worship any god you want as long as you bow to me. And that father of the Maccabean family, they said he was a leader in the community, and he should set the example by sacrificing to Antiochus. And he said, not only will, this is what they want to call Hanukkah, a feast of lights, because they like to play this down. He said, not only will I not do it, I'll kill every man, woman, and child in the village that does. And the Maccabean Rebellion was launched. The apocryphal books taken out with American and British Bible societies include those Maccabean books, and they've been in every Bible since the three oldest, clear through Luther, Tyndale, and King James. But they defeated Antiochus Epiphanes and brought freedom again to the Jewish people, cleaned up the rubble in the temple, lit the menorah again, That's the basis for the Festival of Lights. But Hanukkah needs to reemphasize that it was a celebration of freedom, of breaking the yoke of an earthly government that would interfere with and demand allegiance in defiance of your first allegiance, which is to God. It happened in the December period, and the Feast of Hanukkah is a feast of God's people and people who love God resisting tyranny that would interfere with their faith and their worship. That's a legitimate historic religious festival in December. But not Christmas. Do I want to do away with Christmas? No. I want to shut up those who say put Christ back into Christmas. He never was in it. Have a good time. Gather around it. It has warmth and meanings that go beyond the so-called Christian attachments. Families gather around the Christmas tree. Just tell the truth to your kids. It's not some holy Christian festival. Jesus wasn't born in December. Christmas, December 25th, is the day designated on our calendars as the day of Christ's birth. But is this really the day on which he was born? Are today's customs at this season of Christian origin? Or is Christmas just another example of mixture between paganism and Christianity? Like the Da Vinci Code book said on other matters. But Constantine didn't do the mix. A look at the word Christmas indicates that it is a mixture. Christ and Mass. From Massa, which were the little round cakes baked primarily down in Egypt as the origin in honor of the Queen of the Heavens. Now, the monstrous but round wafers, well, I'm glad to read in the paper, I've been teaching on these subjects, that at least the Cardinal in Los Angeles is quit using the wafers and is starting to use bread. Doesn't say whether he's breaking it or not, but it was broken bread that Jesus took. The wafers came in because they're a sign of the sun, and that's why they wouldn't let you break the wafer. They'd put it on the tongue of the believer. And of course, in the Middle Ages, they argued and debated, and Constantine had nothing to do with it. If the blood and flesh of Jesus literally is transubstantiated to these elements, and the oracular statement, Hocus Corpus Meus, this is my body, actually occurs, as transubstantiation says, then the question was asked, if you crumble a cracker and a piece of it falls on the floor and a rat eats the crumb, do we have a Jesus-filled rat? And that's when they stop breaking the bread or crumbling the wafer and letting the believer even handle it. It put in your mouth and swallowed before the crumb slips out and the rat eats Jesus. That's where we get our English phrase, hocus pocus. This comes out of the ancient Babylonian practice of eating the gods or eating the representatives of deities in their pantheon of divine worshipped beings. The word Canabaal comes from the Chaldean priests of Baal who eat Baal. Canabaal. To eat Baal. And we get cannibal from that. Cannibal. I eat you. This is an ancient custom. In fact, most of the animals that were forbidden to be eaten by the Jew was based upon the fact that most of the animals they were forbidden to eat were deities in some of the Middle Eastern countries and cultures and languages. The dog was worshipped in Egypt. The pig was worshipped by the Chaldeans. So the things that they were forbidden to eat was the attempt to separate them Some were for health reasons, but many of them were simply to prohibit what the heathen did of eating their god and thus partaking of their god. It's a heathen custom. Right, let's go back to Christmas. But Christmas already introduces it. Christ, Masa, a heathen practice with Christ. The word Christmas is thus self-contradictory. Is the actual date of Christ's birth, December 25th, be doubted? When Jesus was born, quote, Luke 2:8, there were in the same country shepherds abiding in the field, keeping watch over their flock by night. Boy, they must have been laying under some sheep because it was awful cold. Live woolen blankets, and I ain't going any further than that. Shepherds in Palestine did not abide in the fields during the middle of winter. Adam Clark, one of the great Bible scholars, has written, quote, as these shepherds had not yet brought home their flocks, it is a presumptive argument that October had not yet commenced, and that consequently our Lord was not born on the 25th of December, when no flocks were out in the fields. On this very ground, the nativity in December should be given up. That mean I can't have Christmas? Now, if your employee gives you a day off, enjoy it. Just don't try to Christianize it. While the Bible does not expressly tell us the date of Jesus' birth, I can tell you, it doesn't miss it by much. I'm not going to take that time tonight. But we know exactly when John the Baptist was conceived. The courses of the priests in the temple are kept as tight records from the days of the return from Babylon to the New Testament time. And the father of John the Baptist, his course is named so we know when he was serving to the day and the hour. And the angel sent him home to make a baby. Short and simple. We know the course, we know the date, and he went home. And that was in the spring. And we know that John was 6 months older than Jesus. And 6 months from the date of John's birth brings you to the Feast of the Trumpets, or September, the start of the civil year. Though the Bible, though it doesn't expressly tell us the date, you can deduce it that it was in the fall. September, Feast of the Trumpets. Why not? Jesus fulfilled every single feast day. The translation of feast, when it says these are the feasts of the Lord in Leviticus, the translation is these are the set times of the Lord. He wouldn't go at the other feast when they wanted him to go, the Feast of the Tabernacles. He said, the time is not yet. He went when the time was Passover. He was crucified on Passover, in the grave when the Feast of Unleavened Bread started, rose on the first day of the week when the Feast of First Fruits was named. He was the substance of which these feast days were the shadow, prophetically. The Feast of the Trumpets has two silver trumpets that are blown all day. They, silver, represent redemption. He has two comings, the first coming and the second coming. He fulfilled the Feast of the Trumpets, first trumpet, when he came the first time. I've said for years, I don't know when the Lord will return. But whatever year he returns, it'll be on the Feast of the Trumpets. And I'm telling you, he won't come this year. He won't come in 2004. So go ahead and relax, everybody. Sin all you want. There are better reasons to come to God than because you think his coming is imminent. But we rejoice that it is. But Jesus taught common sense. He named the signs of the time, said you can read weather. You know when the storm's coming. These signs will occur, but the time is not yet. And another sign, but the time is not yet. You can't know when, but you can know when it's at the door. And there are too many signs to be consumed in 1 year that yet remain. So relax, you ain't coming this year. I'll bet you the budget of my church you won't be here come Feast of the Trumpets 2004. What about the next year? Well, wait till this time next year and let me analyze the signs a bit more. While the Bible does not expressly tell us the date of Jesus' birth, there are indications it was probably in the fall of the year. His argument, we know that Jesus was crucified in spring at the time of the Passover, John 18. Figuring his ministry as lasting 3.5 years, this would place the beginning of his ministry in the fall. At that time, he was about to be 30 years of age, Luke 3, the recognized age for a man to become an official minister under the Old Testament, Numbers 4. If he turned 30 in the fall, then his birthday was in the fall 30 years before. And 3.5 years takes him to the spring, Passover, when he was crucified. At the time of Jesus' birth, Joseph and Mary had gone to Bethlehem to be taxed, Luke 2. There are no records to indicate that the middle of winter was the time of taxing. The Romans weren't dumb. They were going to catch these Jews who went 3 times a year to Jerusalem, and the population that was normally about 120,000 inhabitants would grow to 2 million plus. And that's when they were going to tax them. They wouldn't go in the middle of winter. There wasn't any feast in the middle of the winter. More likely it'd be either Feast of Passover, Feast of Pentecost, or the start of the civil year. Passover started the religious year, which is in the fall, starting with the Feast of the Trumpets, Day of Atonement, and Feast of Tabernacles. The season of the Feast of the Trumpets and Feast of the Tabernacles would explain why Mary went with Joseph, Luke 2, and would explain why even at Bethlehem there was no room at the inn. 2 million people pouring into Jerusalem would spill over into 5 miles away into Bethlehem. He was born in the fall. Early Christians commemorated the death of Christ, not his birth. The Catholic Encyclopedia says Christmas was not. I'm going to continue. Get on the telephone. Well, you got on the telephone, so I'm going to continue. Complete your calls. Don't take any more calls. I'm going to keep reading this book, Babylon, Mystery Religion, by Ralph Edward Woodrow. About 27 minutes from now, we'll take you into the cathedral for this morning's service. The early Christians commemorated the death of Christ, not his birth. The Catholic Encyclopedia says, quote, Christmas was not among the earliest festivals of the church. Irenaeus and Tertullian. Irenaeus was the Bishop of Lyon and wrote the great Magnus Opus against heresy. And Tertullian, the Bishop of North Africa, more influential in determining the books that ultimately were fixed as the canon than anyone else. And Constantine had nothing to do with this. Irenaeus and Tertullian omit Christmas from their lists of feasts. That takes us up to the 5th century. Later, when churches at various places did begin celebrating the birthday of Christ, there was much difference of opinion as to the correct date. It was not until the latter part of the 4th century before the Roman Church began observing December 25th. And that did not mean the rest of the church world were ready to accept it. Yet, by the 5th century, it was ordering that the birth of Christ be forever observed on this date, even though this was the day of the old Roman feast of the birth of soul, one of the names of the sun god. That's the Catholic Encyclopedia's statement that it was eliminated from the list. The latter statement, I didn't stop the quote at the right place. The latter statement is just a simple historic statement by this author, and it's true. Says Fraser, because I've already said by the 5th century, it wasn't even in a list of Tertullian, who helped more than anyone canonize the scripture, says Fraser, quote, the largest pagan religious cult, which fostered the celebration of December 25th as a holiday throughout the Roman and Greek worlds, was the pagan sun worship, Mithraism. This winter festival was called, quote, the Nativity of the Sun. You see, after Constantine and the Council of Nicaea, subsequent Roman emperors harassed Christians over peripheral issues, and Mithraism still dominated Rome. Constantine had moved his capital to Constantinople, and the Byzantium Empire dominated under Constantine, and his mother helped open most of the sites in Jerusalem and in the Holy Land. But at Rome, Mithraism still ruled. Most of Rome was still barbaric. I remember even as, my Lord, how long ago was it? When I was in undergraduate school, majoring in history, classical, Roman, and Greek, the professor that I used introduced the first textbook that studied Roman history from the Byzantium frame of reference, which was the cultural heart of the empire as Constantine moved it there. And that's why that in the so-called dominant holy sees, every one of those apostolic sees were founded by an apostle, except Constantinople, which was the center of the eastern part of the empire with Constantine's residence there. But in Rome, Mithraism, barbarians for the large part. The winter festival was called the Nativity of the Sun. Was this pagan festival responsible for the December 25th day being chosen by the Roman Church? Let's allow the Catholic Encyclopedia to answer. Quote, the well-known solar feast of Natalis Invicti, the Nativity of the Unconquered Sun, celebrated on 25th December, has a strong claim on the responsibility for our December date. Catholic Encyclopedia. As pagan solar customs were being Christianized at Rome, it is understandable that confusion would result. Some thought Jesus was Sol, the sun god. Tertullian, again, I've said who he is often enough, had to assert that Sol was not the Christian's god. Augustine denounced the heretical identification of Christ with Sol. Pope Leo I bitterly reproved solar survivals. Christians on the very doorstep of the Apostles' Basilica turning to adore the rising sun. End quote. The winter festival was very popular in ancient times. In pagan Rome and Greece, in the days of the Teutonic barbarians, in the remote times of ancient Egyptian civilization, in the infancy of the race, east and west and north and south, the period of the winter solstice was ever a period of rejoicing and festivity. Because this season was so popular, it was adopted at the time of the birth of Christ by the Roman Church. If you can't beat them, join them, is the idea. But it begins back in Babylon, where Nimrod was identified as Baal, the sun god who had been here for a time, married Semiramis. She conceived a son after his death. She launches the program that, as I said earlier, Nimrod returned to his home in the sky, and she became pregnant by a sunbeam, and Nimrod was reborn as Tammuz. And that's his birth when the sun starts to rise again in the sky. It's the origin of all of it. Some of our present-day Christmas customs were influenced by the Roman Saturnalia. It's common knowledge, says one writer, that much of our association with the Christmas season, the holidays, the giving of presents, the general feeling of geniality, is but the inheritance from the Roman winter festival of the Saturnalia, survivals of paganism. The traffic and Christ could not have produced what we face at Christmas time here in the traffic and the shopping, Christ could not have produced that. That's straight from something Antichrist. There's nothing wrong with giving presents, of course. But some have sought to link Christmas gifts with those presented to Jesus by the wise men. This cannot be correct. By the time the wise men arrived, Jesus was no longer lying in a manger, as when the shepherds came, but was in a house. Read it in Matthew 2, 9-11. This could have been quite a while after his birthday, even if it were Christmas. And they presented their gifts to Jesus, not to each other. The Christmas tree, as we know it, only dates back a few centuries. Though ideas about sacred trees are very ancient, an old Babylonish fable told of an evergreen tree which sprang out of a dead tree stump. The old stump symbolized the dead Nimrod. The new evergreen tree symbolized that Nimrod had come to life again in Tammuz. Among the Druids, the oak was sacred. Among the Egyptians, it was the palm, and in Rome, it was the fir, which was decorated with red berries during the Saturnalia. The Scandinavian god Odin was believed to bestow special gifts at Yuletide to those who approached his sacred fir tree. In at least 10 biblical references, the green tree was associated with idolatry and false worship. Since all trees are green at least part of the year, the special mention of green probably refers to trees that are evergreen. The Christmas tree recapitulates the idea of tree worship. Gilded nuts and balls symbolize the sun. All of the just stay where you're at, folks. Don't make a move. Gilded nuts and balls symbolize the sun. Gilded nuts and balls symbolize the sun. All of the festivities of the winter solstice have been absorbed into Christmas Day. By the way, those planes you showed, in case you're asking, that's not Michael Jackson escaping. The Christmas tree, gilded nuts and balls symbolize the sun. All of the festivities of the winter solstice have been absorbed into Christmas Day. You have a carnal imagination. The use of holly and mistletoe from the Druidic ceremonies, the Christmas tree from honors paid to Odin's sacred fir. Taking all this into consideration, it's interesting to compare a statement of Jeremiah with today's custom of decorating a tree at the Christmas season. Jeremiah 10, quote, "The customs of the people are vain. For one cutteth a tree out of the forest, the work of the hands of the workmen with the axe. They deck it with silver and with gold. They fasten it with nails and with hammers, that it move not. They are upright as the palm tree, but speak not." Now, of course, he's condemning those who worship these creations of idols. And I don't think anybody worships the Christmas tree. Have fun, folks. I mean, you know. Bring the gifts, put them there. Have fun. The only people who should be unhappy at Christmas are turkeys. Gather around the Christmas tree. Practice one day of gluttony. Exchange gifts and recall warm memories. But don't call it Christmas. It's just one real, fun, heathen holiday. In the 6th century, missionaries were sent through the northern part of Europe to gather pagans into the Roman fold. They found that June 24th was a very popular day among these people. They sought to Christianize this day, but how? By this time, December 25th had been ordered by the Roman Church as the birthday of Christ. Since June 24th was approximately 6 months before December 25th, why not call this the birthday of John the Baptist? Because it's clear John was born 6 months earlier, though I've told you, you can find in the course of the priests that John's father was serving and the records that have been kept since the temple was rebuilt, you know exactly when the angel told him to go home and produce a child. But they decided John was born 6 months earlier, and here is this wonderful heathen ceremony on June 24th, which is approximately 6 months earlier. Therefore, June 24th is known on the papal calendar now as St. John's Day. In Britain, before the entrance of Christianity there, June 24th was celebrated by the Druids with blazing fires in honor of Baal. Herodotus, Wilkinson, Lollard, and other historians tell of these ceremonial fires in different countries. When June 24th became St. John's Day, the sacred fires were adopted also and became St. John's fires. These are mentioned as such in the Catholic Encyclopedia. Quote, another author says, I have seen the people running and leaping through the St. John's fires in Ireland, this writer of the past century says, proud of passing through unsinged, thinking themselves in a special manner blessed for the ceremony. Such rites honored Molech, not John the Baptist. June 24th was regarded as being sacred to the ancient fish god, Oannes, O-A-N-N-E-S, a name by which Nimrod was known. In an article on Nimrod, the historian Fawcett says, quote, Oannes the fish god, Babylon's civilizer, rose out of the Red Sea. In the Latin language of the Roman Church, John was called Joannes. Notice how similar this is to Oannes. Just add a J in front of it. Such similarities help promote St. John's Day, a day which in pagan times had been regarded as sacred to Isis or Diana. August 15th was simply renamed as the day of the Assumption of the Virgin Mary, and right up to our present time is still highly honored. Another day adopted from paganism, supposedly to honor Mary, is called Candlemas, or the Purification of the Blessed Virgin, and is celebrated on February 2nd. In Mosaic law, after giving birth to a male child, a mother was considered unclean for 40 days, Leviticus 12, which Mary and Joseph would be submitting to. And when the days of her purification, according to the law of Moses, were accomplished, Joseph and Mary presented the holy baby Jesus in the temple and offered the prescribed sacrifice, Luke 2:22-24, and Leviticus 12, you have the 40-day requirement. Having adopted December 25th as the nativity or birth of Christ, the February 2nd date seemed to fit in well with the time of the purification of Mary. I mean, it's like laying out a trip for yourself and putting a peg in the map as a starting point, and it's different than the right starting point. Once they decided December 25th, they keep looking for these other coordinates. But what did this have to do with the use of candles on this day? I mean, if you're going to have Christ born the 25th and you adopt this February date as the purification day, what does this have to do with the use of candles on this day? In pagan Rome, this festival was observed with the carrying of torches and candles in honor of Februa, from whom our month of February is named. The Greeks held the feast in honor of the goddess Ceres, the mother of Proserpina, who was candle-bearing celebrants searched for her in the underworld. Thus, we can see how adopting February 2nd to honor the purification of Mary was influenced by pagan customs involving candles, even to calling it Candlemas Day. On this day, all of the candles to be used during the year in Catholic rituals are blessed. An old drawing shows the Pope distributing blessed candles to the priest. Says the Catholic Encyclopedia, we need not shrink from admitting that candles, like incense and lustral water, were commonly employed in pagan worship and in rites paid to the dead. That's enough for tonight. But Christmas just put a halo around a heathen feast of Saturnalia. They couldn't stop the party, so they just put a halo around it and joined in. Well, keep the party. But tell your kids the truth, because one of these days they'll find out that they've been lied to about December 25th, and that may make them question everything else that they've been told. Separate fact from fancy, truth from fiction, Enjoy the fiction. It's one of the few heathen things, if you don't do too much eggnog stuff, that you can probably survive as a Christian. Treat it as a family gathering. You don't have to tell your kids all the stuff I'm telling you until they're old enough to understand, but don't tell them the lies either. And we're besieged. Just keep Hanukkah. And this candle, or this phallic symbol, you don't have to tell them what that means either. You and your wife talk about it after the kids go to bed. Just make a nice family gathering out of it. Now, get on the telephone. I had them fade the song away because I'm not sure you're ready for this. We have bears up on the ranch where you saw us riding the horses, Silver Oaks Ranch. They have bears up there. They make their home in my swimming pool. They act like they own the ranch. But they sort of stayed away from the main house side of the ranch. We went the other morning to some place over in Monrovia and got one of these chocolate-filled, demon urge, one of these chocolate-filled croissants. And we were sitting on the main porch. I got to tell this fast, you got to see it before 9:30. We were sitting on the main porch, and she tore it in half so I could get half of this demon-inspired breakfast treat. And the chocolate sort of fell out in one big wad. Now, I'm going to be blunt. It looked like bear droppings. So I decided to play a little trick on some of my people that needed, they've been persecuting me, my staff people, I said. So I got on radio and told them to come up to the porch. Now, in front of the porch, there's a brick area, and then there's a brick curb, and then there's the driveway. And we laid this chocolate that looked just like a bear dropping, and it was soft enough to be malleable, but still cling together. And we laid it there right on that brick, and I brought up my staff members. One of them is a lady, and the other one's a chief gardener. And I said, up till now, I've had no trouble with bears here on this ranch. And Brandy was one. Brandy, didn't you clean up here today? How'd you miss that bear dropping there, right in front of my door? Pick it up! She grabs the rack. No, with your fingers. You didn't do your job right, so you need to pick it up. Finally she picks it up. Hold it like this. You'll see it. I said, smell of it! No, it can't be. Smell of it! Maybe you'll learn to clean up here from now on. Smell of it! You watch the film. It was Candid Camera.